What you have to understand is that I am not going to go anywhere. I am not going anywhere. And the reason why I am not going anywhere is because all of the talent has fled the Labour Party. Everybody other than me is not very intelligent, is not very high in their support, will split the party, or will just make things even worse. And therefore, I am confident that my party are like rabbits in the headlights. They are frozen. They don't know what to do. They're too scared. In the words of Margaret Thatcher, they are frit. And so I am going to take this party to the oblivion that it deserves to be taken to. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, as I speak to you, it's the 13th of May, and it's a Wednesday. And on my Monday live stream, we were debating whether Keir Starmer would be gone by, you know, when he would be gone. And I suggested by summer. And those who were live streaming with me said, oh, well, probably by the end of the week. And I didn't think that. I didn't agree with that. And there were reasons why I didn't agree with that. There are reasons why Keir Starmer is holding on and is able to hold on. And the key reason for it, basically, is the collapse of talent on the left, what I call the Rayner effect. And that is what I want to look at today. Before I do that, would you do me a favor? Would you please subscribe? Could you subscribe on YouTube? Could you subscribe on leave a like, leave a comment for the algorithm, and subscribe on my Substack. That's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based stuff, stuff that I can't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, films I make, and where, if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of a pint of beer a month. Okay, back to the video. So what is going on? For those of you that are in America or are not familiar with what's been happening in the UK, last Thursday, the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer's party, the Labour Party, experienced probably one of their worst defeats ever. They lost over 1,000 council seats. They lost a large number of their seats in very important constituencies to Reform, which is the anti-EU, anti-immigration sort of but socially acceptable party. They lost the Welsh Senedd to the Welsh Parliament, that is, to the Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalist Party. They failed to make any progress at all in Scotland, so that the Scottish Parliament is still in the hands of the SNP. It was disastrous. And if those results were repeated, then there would be a Reform minority government in the House of Commons after the next election, and Labour would be reduced to a rump of about 100 MPs, if not fewer. So they were absolutely disastrous results. What we would expect would be for the Labour Party to say to themselves, well, there's no way we're going to win under Keir Starmer. He's deeply unpopular on the doorstep. Nobody likes him. He's particularly unpopular, because of his response to the Southport riots, which was tone deaf and was basically accusing those that were very, very angry. OK, they shouldn't have been rioting, but were very, very angry of being far right thugs. And secondly, then there's his mendacity with regard to the appointment of Peter Mandelson, who is on the Epstein, you know, friendship list, to be the American ambassador, even though it seems that he almost certainly knew that Mandelson was connected to Epstein. So it looks very, very bad. So he's lost authority. He's lost anything he once had in terms of being given a crack of the whip at governing. It's looking terrible, and they would have to get rid of him. But it hasn't quite turned out that way. He's basically, the momentum was there at the beginning. You had, I believe I'm right in saying, four ministers of state that resigned. Something like 80 members of parliament stating that they feel that Keir Starmer should go. But those four ministers that resigned were quite obscure ministers. They weren't anybody that particularly mattered. They certainly weren't cabinet ministers. And you had Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, publicly stating, or it being leaked that she had stated to him that he should go. But then the momentum has kind of gone. What was supposed to happen, what those people that resigned were hoping would happen, would be that there would be a similar situation to what happened with Boris, which is that cabinet ministers start resigning. And then once that happens, it's over. But that has not happened. Why has it not happened? Why has there been this weak attempt at a coup, which seems to have now lost all momentum and fallen apart? And the key answer is the collapse of talent in the Labour Party. The people that are in the Labour Party realise, the members of the Parliamentary Labour Party understand, they know each other, they know who's who and who has talent and who has ability. And they realise that essentially, if they get rid of Starmer, it could just get worse. It could get very, very considerably worse for them. It could mean the total and utter destruction of their party at the next election. And so they are resigned to keeping their extremely unpopular leader and resigned to going down to a defeat, a big defeat, for want of the possibility that that defeat could be even worse. Now, how has this happened? The key thing that I have talked about before is what I call the Rayner effect. This is that we are all becoming less intelligent. We are losing something like, according to various studies that I've looked at in my book, The Past is a Future Country, The Coming Conservative Democratic Revolution, we are losing something like 1.5 IQ points per decade. We know that this is for genetic reasons, because the prevalence of alleles associated with intelligence is going down across time in human genome analysis. And there are various reasons for this that I've looked at ad nauseum elsewhere, such as that more intelligent women tend to delay their fertility and therefore are becoming mothers at the same time that the less intelligent women, such as Angela Rayner, who had a child at 16 and was a grandmother at 37, are becoming grandmothers. More intelligent people seem to just not want to have children. They don't want them for some reason. Possibly they're more environmentally sensitive in an evolutionary mismatch, and intelligence involves environmental sensitivity. It involves rising above your instincts and solving the problem. And so they are, if you're lower in instinct, you will be more intelligent, you'll solve problems better. And so consequently, they have less of an instinct to have children. The instinct is not brought out. Thirdly, it is to do with the efficient use of contraception, and low intelligence it means that you won't be able to do that. And there are other issues as well. But we are definitely becoming in the West less intelligent. But when you control for intelligence, when you look at, let's say, just the top quartile of intelligence, then you find something quite interesting in the data. And that is that the big predictor of having children is that you are conservative and that you are religious in the traditional sense of the collective worship of a moral god. And the big predictor of not having children is that you are an atheist and that you are a liberal. And the genetic component to whether you are conservative or not is somewhere in the region of 40 to 60%. So that means that we're all becoming less intelligent, those that are on the left and those that are on the right. But those that are on the left, and I'm talking only about analysis of white people here, only about analysis of native Europeans, those that are on the left are becoming less intelligent more quickly. This I call the Rayner effect after Angela Rayner, because it is inconceivable until relatively recently that you could get someone whose intelligence is as low as that of Angela Rayner being at a high level as well, not just an MP, but at a high level, the deputy prime minister as she was before she had to resign for cocking up her taxes in British politics. So that is the Rayner effect. And I think you are seeing this play out. There are two kinds, the Labour coalition is two groups of people, foreigners, and it is often in the interests of a foreigner for a country to be left wing. In a sense, the last thing you want if you are a foreigner is a nationalist society. And this is why the people of Rhodesia, the white minority, voted for a right wing pro-white party in the form of Ian Smith's party. But then eventually when Robert Mugabe came in and it became black majority rule and he was essentially a black nationalist, then they started voting for his opposition, which was a trade unionist organized socialist party. Did they suddenly become socialists? No, they realized it wasn't in their interests to have a black nationalist governing the country that they as white people lived in. So you have people like that on the left in Labour, and then you just have the native left. Now, what are they going to be? Well, I've looked before at why. There's those that just identify with a class other than their own because they're basically individualists, and it's a way of subtly gaining status, and so playing for status without being noticed because you're virtue signalling and people think you're a lovely person, whereas in reality you're creating a coalition with another group of people to rule over your own group, which is the upper middle class, white people or whatever. So there's those kinds of people. And there's simply working class people who are militating in their own in favour of their own interests, which was a lot of the traditional Labour Party. But that's who they are. Now, they are those white people that are left wing, as I've said, are losing intelligence considerably more quickly than white people who are right wing because they're not having children. Why are they not having children? I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that I don't need to necessarily. I've looked at in many other videos. I call it woke eugenics, which is that it is those people that are highly materialistic. So they don't, because they're atheists. So they don't have children. They put material above having children. They are drawn in by things like being guilty for being white, or being guilty for being human, or being guilty for being male, or whatever it happens to be. And so therefore they resign from the gene pool, with the result that among the more intelligent, you end up with people who are more right wing and more conservative. And I think you're seeing this play out now. It's been going on for a long time. And I think you're seeing this play out now in the Labour Party. You had a number of people post Tony Blair, post Gordon Brown, who had a certain level of intelligence, a certain oomph, a certain kind of charisma, a certain ability to charm people and make people feel good, make a cold world feel warm again, as it were, and also come across as highly competent. Because that is what we look for in a leader. We look for a person who is reasonably intelligent, i.e. that they are signalling that they can solve problems, solve the problems that we have, that is diplomatic, i.e. they can hold a social group together, hold a coalition together, hold society together, that will successfully be able to distribute resources so that everybody feels that they've got a reasonable amount of the pie, and so that there's social harmony, but also they have to have a sort of charisma that people warm to them and people like them and so on, and so that they're attractive as a voting prospect, whether that is an open, clear charisma like Boris, that he makes people laugh and makes people feel good or whatever, or the sort of quieter kind, but who comes across nevertheless as quite solid, someone like Jim Callaghan or whatever. Now, I'm just racking my brains to think of, well, who are these people that are like this within the Labour Party in recent decades? And what happened was that, of course, Labour was taken over by the far left. Basically, Labour had the shock, the terrible, terrible shock of defeat with Gordon Brown, which I think they didn't expect. And so in a kind of fury, and the Conservatives did the same thing. It's often what you do. If you're in denial about something, if something terrible has happened to you and you're in denial and you can't understand what's going on and you want structure and you want order, then often you will deal with that. And there's good evidence for this. Fundamentalism is associated with times of stress and times of feeling unhappy and mortality salience. That's what's associated with going through periods of religious fundamentalism. And it seems to be also true with going through periods of political extremism. So if you look at the Conservative Party, if we believe in that old adage that as a rule, in normal political times, you have to be at the centre. If we believe in that idea that you don't go too extreme, the Conservative Party loses the 1997 election. Terrible, terrible defeat. Unbelievable defeat. Appalling defeat. Worst defeat in almost 100 in something like 90 years since 1906. And what do? Well, they elect someone who is strongly anti-European and strongly right-wing, really, in the form of William Hague, by the standards of the time. And that was not the view of the people. That was not what people wanted. That was not the mood of the nation almost 29 years ago. And so he wasn't, he, if you see him speak, he was very charismatic, but he, on TV, he didn't come across very well. He was prematurely bald. He was nasal. He wasn't amazingly good looking. He just didn't come across well. And they did, achieved absolutely nothing. And then having achieved absolutely nothing, they then again, they elected someone even more extreme in the form of Ian Duncan Smith. And then that made it was clear there was going to be total disaster. They finally this shook a bit of sense into them. And then they elected Michael Howard as a caretaker leader, who was seen as a sort of sensible elder statesman to steady the ship, by which time people were sick of New Labour and there was the Iraq War. And then eventually they elected David Cameron, who came across as new and young and whatever, and was able to wipe the floor with Blair and then defeat Gordon Brown. Now, this process is what we seem to have seen with the Labour Party, in so much as the Labour Party are defeated. They should have elected David Miliband. They should have. David Miliband, sensible, intelligent, reasonably good looking, good public speaker, reasonably charismatic. But they didn't do that. They, in the shock that they were in and the sort of sense of spite that they were in, they elected his younger brother, Ed Miliband, who was far to the left, who was not as good looking, who was the beta male, who was Niles to the Fraser, and he did not connect with the British people, who was a disaster, and who then duly lost the 2015 election. Rather like the Conservatives losing the 2001 election. Then they go really bonkers. Then we have the shock, the fundamentalism, the turning to extremes, the wanting structure and order, the turning in on themselves. And we have the election of Jeremy Corbyn, who was never going to get anywhere because he was so extreme. This gnome looking man. Who was so to the far left, who was so crazy that he had very little parliamentary support, but the point is that he was supported by his own party. You then have a party in chaos, and of course they then lose in a landslide. But before they do that, of course, it seems that Labour starts to give up. The talent in Labour, to the extent that it is there, magic grandpa, says Charlie Pepper, that's a very good point, the magic grandpa, to the extent that there is somewhat any talent there, people start to think, for God's sake, Labour's not going to go anywhere. Labour's going to be out of power for a very long time. This is a waste of my time. I'm off. And this is not something that happened in the Conservative Party. Because it didn't get that bad. It didn't get to the point where the Conservative Party went so bonkers. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher supported Ian Duncan Smith, for example. There'd be no question of Tony Blair supporting Jeremy Corbyn. So that went so bonkers that people just started thinking there's no hope and resigning from Parliament. But that is what happened with Labour. The most talented people of the generation that would now have sufficient political experience and allies and whatever to be in power started to just go. So David Miliband left. David Miliband resigned, having been humiliated by his own brother. He resigned and went off somewhere to work somewhere in America or something. There was another guy called Tristan Hunt. Does anyone remember him? Who was highly charismatic and good looking and, you know, had a certain something. Well, he resigned, went off. No good. The party's doomed. This is pointless. Off he goes. And Andy Burnham did the same thing. And off he went. And became mayor of Manchester. And so then there's very few people that are left. There's a guy called Douglas Alexander, who seems quite sensible to me, but he managed to lose his seat at, I forget which election it was. Was it the 2015 election when the SNP did very well? And then was out of power and so lost momentum and so on. And so he's been basically demoted. He's gone from being shadow foreign secretary, I believe he was, under Ed Miliband, to being something silly like shadow culture secretary or something low down or whatever. So there's really no one of any significant talent. And then what are you left with? You're left with Wes Streeting. Well, apparently he's a very divisive figure and he doesn't have enough support on the left of the party. And remember that who elects the Labour leader is not just the members of Parliament. It's the members of Parliament and the members of the party at large who are way to the left of the Labour Party and the trade unions, who are, of course, way to the left of the Labour Party. So if they had the situation in 1980, when it was the MPs only that voted for the leader of the Labour Party, then perhaps this Streeting guy might be in with a crack of the whip, but apparently not. And soundings have been taking place, and it's emerging that it's no good that 80 MPs have said, no, we don't support Keir Starmer and he should go. The only way he could be removed is that they get behind a single candidate. And it seems that he does not have enough support for him to be that candidate. So that's it. It's just freezing. It's just a rabbit in the headlights. As I've said, there's nothing they can do. He's out. Another possibility is Shabana Mahmood. The problem with her is that she's actually said, she's Pakistani heritage and so on, but she's actually said some quite base things about immigration and all that kind of thing, which, of course, is a problem when you have a party, a significant proportion of whom are on, you know, the trade unionists and the members at large are extremely left wing and very, very pro-immigration and very, very spiteful. And so she's obviously not, even if she were to garner sufficient support to bid against Starmer, which is potentially unlikely, she wouldn't be elected anyway. And they know that. And so, therefore, that would be a waste of time as well. And then finally, you have Angela Rayner. And surely everybody realizes that this woman is, at the moment, people don't really mind that much about her because she's not prime minister yet. But everything will come out once she's prime minister, everything. It's clear if you look at Lord Ashcroft's biography of her, The Red Queen, or even the research I've done, that she's economical with the actualité, that she exaggerates the poverty of her childhood, says that her mother gave them dog food to eat because she couldn't read and she thought that the tin implied braising steak, which is obviously wrong because it would be a dog on the tin. It's obviously made up. It's exaggerated. That she had to clean her teeth with shaving cream. That seems to me to be exaggerated. And that her mother was one of 12 and ran away with the fairground and two of the children were given away to neighbours because they were so poor. And as I said, I know one seems to be interested in this loan, but I've looked into it and she wasn't one of 12. She was one of two. And these kinds of things are irrelevant now, but they will start to emerge, as will her stupidity, her lack of intelligence, her lack of impulse control, her basically narcissistic kind of characteristics, which is what Lord Ashcroft highlighted in the biography, if you read it. So she's no good. She would obviously, she doesn't have the intellectual capacity. She would be a complete disaster as leader of the Labour Party, and they know that. So. There's just nobody. And they realize that. And it's not even like in the 1990s when people were fed up of John Major after the crash in 1992 and Black Wednesday and so forth. And then in 1995, there was all this carping about the leadership. And he said, put up or shut up. And the most obscure member of the cabinet, John Redwood, put up and got 89 votes and was roundly defeated by John Major. And that was the end of that. There's nobody like that. There seems to be nobody even of that caliber who they can put up. There's nobody. There's been this talk of a stalking horse, but that happened with Margaret Thatcher in the form of Sir Anthony Mayer, who got a derisory vote, but she held on. You have to have somebody of caliber that everybody can gather behind. Now, the weird thing is that under Major, there were people of caliber, of charisma and ability that might have come and removed him, such as Michael Portillo or Michael Heseltine or Ken Clark. But those people sort of wanted to kept their powder dry, didn't want to be disloyal, didn't want to cause a crisis at that point, hoped that the economy doing well would mean that the British people would be sensible enough not to vote Labour. But of course, they overestimated the intelligence and logic of the British people, and the new Labour was the result. But there's nobody now. There's nobody, as far as I can see, who is in the cabinet of discernible talent. And the fury about Labour on the doorsteps is such that even if somebody does stand down to permit Andy Burnham to be a Member of Parliament. This, of course, happened with Sir Alec Douglas Hume when he became Prime Minister in 1963. He was the Earl of Hume, and then he resigned his peerage and he had to wait for some Scottish MP to stand down, and then he was elected. But even if that happens, this was at a point of where the Conservatives were doing quite well in the polls. The anti-Labour feeling is so pronounced that there is no reason to assume that Andy Burnham would win that by-election. And had he stood in the by-election in Gorton Denton, which the Greens, of course, won, there is no reason to assume that he would have won that. It may be that wherever he stands, he just loses. If he stands in somewhere like Norwich, where there's a guy called Clive Lewis, who is an MP for somewhere in Norwich, who's talked of standing down, or perhaps he'll be soundly beaten by Reform. And if he stands somewhere that's multi-ethnic or whatever in Manchester, there's every reason to think he'd be beaten by the Greens. So the result is that they are just frozen. And in a way, as a patriot, I would like Angela Rayner to be elected, because it would completely and utterly, surely, just destroy the Labour Party. But then we have to balance that with the extent to which it would destroy the country in the process. Whereas I think that with this guy in charge, with this guy remaining in charge, he'll just do nothing. He'll just do nothing until he's forced to call an election. He'll do nothing. He's a manager. He's a bland, technocratic manager with no ideas. He'll just do nothing. Things will just get gradually worse. With Angela, things would get dramatically worse. Labour would be completely polarised. God knows what would happen. But you could be destabilise everything. The banks could collapse. I mean, it could be appallingly awful. With this guy, it'll just be managed decline until there's the election, and then he's annihilated. So perhaps it is in our interests that Keir Starmer just stays in power. He's eliminated all the opposition, all the possible talented people that could remove him. They've all gone, and he just stays there, and people just become more and more annoyed until there's finally an election, and then Labour are decimated. But this is balanced with the fact that were it to be Angela Rayner that got into power, or were then things would be very, very, very considerably worse. I mean, she could mess up the country to a quite unparalleled degree. So I think he'll probably, unless there's some dramatic break, there had to be the momentum. That was why it was so clever of him to have, so devious of him to put the state opening of Parliament only a few days after the election, the King's speech, only a few days after the election, because it meant it forced people to not act, to not do anything, and it cut the momentum that could have been gathering. He planned that. He obviously planned that. And so he ensured that he stays in power and his party gets to be ultimately destroyed. OK, we've got a couple of super chats. The first is from Olaf SZP, who says, "We have been brainwashed for generations to hate our own kind. No other group on the planet does this. It is unique to Europeans." I agree. I think that we are, it is a reflection that we are extremely high in guilt. And because we are extremely high in guilt, we create close social bonds. It's a pro-social thing. But we're also high in guilt, potentially, at the group level. But before, we've been in relatively harsh conditions in which we're close to death and whatever. And this brings out our instincts, including ethnocentrism and religiosity. And now those instincts are not brought out. And so we just have a generalized guilt. And so this is then our undoing. So it's part of what I've called the genius strategy, that we have relatively low ethnocentrism. And if we're not in the correct environment, that ethnocentrism is not induced. And we're too far from death for ethnocentrism to be induced. And there also may be genetic changes in the population, i.e. we've been selecting out health, and health is associated with things like basically being conservative, that might be relevant to this. But that's a very good point, sir. At the Cruxy says, "Do you like the work of J.D. Unwin?" I do like the work of J.D. Unwin, Mr. Cruxy. And here is the J.D. Unwin book, Sex and Culture, published by Imperium Press, a new edition. A couple of years ago it was published. And who writes the introduction to that book? The introduction is called A Critique of Sex and Culture and the Life of J.D. Unwin. Me, I did. And my name is even on the cover. And I researched his life, and I won't give the game away for you, but if you read what I... It wasn't enough, but I don't think he was famous enough for it to for a book to be justified about him, a biography. But certainly his biography is rather interesting. So you can have a look at that. Okay, and if there are any other questions, otherwise I will wind up. Lost Yank has made a very good point about Rainer and Rains there. That's very good. So it's a very good pun. But if there are any other questions. Otherwise, I will wind up and see you soon. No, okay. Well, then, thanks, chaps. I don't know. Maybe suddenly something will happen. Maybe suddenly something will happen, and I will have egg on my face. Maybe he will resign today. But it looks to me like he's holding on. Okay, thank you very much, chaps. Tally ho, and goodbye.